out will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
Welcome to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On today's episode, we have two special guests, Eddie Robinson and Franco Santoriello. And Eddie and Franco were two of the top bodybuilders in the 1980s, early 1990s. They were both incredible teenage champions, and they both had amazing genetic potential. Eddie and Franco were kind of rivals because Franco beat Eddie at the 1984 Teenage USA Championships, where they both won their height class, but Franco won the overall. And then that rivalry continued all the way up until the 1989 MPC USA Championships, where Eddie and Franco competed in the same weight class, light heavyweights, and then Eddie won the overall. So I brought these guys back on the show all these years later, and it was good to have a reunion between Franco and Eddie, who were rivals in the past, but obviously have a lot of respect for one another. And they obviously have mellowed out a little bit as we've gotten older. So that interview will be coming up in a second. At the end of our interview with Franco and Eddie, I will be reading part three of that Mr. Olympia 1981 report that was written by Rick Wayne. We had part one and part two on a few weeks ago. So we will have part three on this week. And this is a fantastic article, man. And there's another part after this. There's part four. So I'll read part four on our next episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. But this was great contest reporting written by the one and only Rick Wayne, and probably the most controversial Mr. Olympia contest ever. Rick described the lead up to the contest in the first two parts. I think part one, he was talking about all the bodybuilders as they were training for the show. And of course, the controversy of the 1980 Olympia. And then in part two, he talked about mostly the Mr. International competition, which was held with the Mr. Olympia. So now in part three, we get into the Mr. Olympia contest. And I think we go all the way through the prejudging and the night show, all the way up into the final announcement. And Rick leaves us hanging. And so then we will go into part four after that. So really, really good stuff. You guys are going to love this. I have some bad news. A friend of mine, David Young, who used to work for Iron Man magazine, he was a writer. And David has passed away. Unfortunately, David had a stroke a few weeks ago, and it seemed like he was getting better. He posted on Facebook that he had a stroke and he was recovering and everything was looking better. And then I saw Jim Rockell posted last week that David passed away. So man, what a loss. He was a really good guy, a good writer. And he trained at Jim Rockell's gym in New York when he was growing up. Cause I remember he used to always tell me that he used to work out with Danny Padilla a lot. And he had all these stories about training with Danny Padilla. So fortunately, David has passed away. When I did my cover with Iron Man magazine back in 2011, I had known David a few years because I used to go out to the Pro Iron Man contest every once in a while. They would give me free tickets to go see it. So I'd fly down from Chicago to California to see the contest. And I would see David there. But then when I did my cover for Iron Man magazine in 2011, David did a bunch of video interviews with me, which are still on YouTube, by the way, if you want to check them out. And we did about, I think it was like a 4-part video interview. So those are on YouTube, as I mentioned, but he was a great guy. So unfortunately gone way too soon. So rest in peace, David Young, all his family and friends. I wish you all the best. That was a real shame to see him go so young. Another good guy gone. Oh, I've been doing some different stuff with my training. I read something on Facebook. This friend of mine, John Gorman, who is a trainer himself, trains a lot of people, natural bodybuilder. And he said he's been doing high rep training, 30 reps to failure for the last 7 years. And he loves it. And he says he's actually gotten bigger doing it. So I thought I would try it just as a change of pace. And I'm in my second week of doing it now. It's very painful. And it's definitely a different type of training. I'm basically doing the same routine I always have done. But now I'm doing 30 reps. So the first few workouts, I just had to experiment a little bit to find out what weight to use because it's hard to get to that 30 reps. It seems like it's working for some body parts better than others. Like my triceps were super sore doing it. And I really got a lot out of doing shoulders with it too, the side laterals especially. Legs were not as good as I thought because I started with leg extensions, and doing 30 reps on leg extensions burned out my legs. So by the time I got to the leg press, I could barely get 25 reps. And then when I got to squats, that was like a joke. I was doing 135 for, I think, 25 reps, but I wasn't even feeling it. So I kind of got to adjust that a little bit. I might do squats first next time and then do leg press second. Back training wasn't that great. I seemed to, it was like really hard on my forearms and biceps doing 30 reps with bent over rows. I was using 135 pounds on bent over rows, but man, it just kills your grip and your forearms and your biceps. So it seemed to work pretty good with chest. And of course, calves work really good. So I'm trying it out. I'm going to try it for a few weeks and see what happens, see if I get any gains from it. But I might incorporate it every once in a while into my workouts, maybe every 3 weeks or every 4 weeks, throw in a week of high rep training just to see what difference it makes. It's obviously getting more of the slow twitch muscle fibers, because when you train heavy, you know, the 6 to 10 rep range, you're using the fast twitch muscle fibers, which are more responsible for growth. So that's why I didn't think this would, I was kind of skeptical about this working. But the key is, and if you heard our interview with Jerry Branum about a month or so ago, I asked Jerry about high rep training or lighter weight training. And he said there are studies out there showing that lightweight training using light weights can be effective and can grow muscle tissue, but you have to train to failure. And that's what this is all about. You're doing 30 reps, but that 30th rep or the 25th rep is the absolute last one you can get. And so that's what we've been doing. So it's very painful. It's honestly, it's not as enjoyable as training heavier. I used to like going to the gym and knowing what weights I was going to use, and it was a challenge. And I actually like that type of training better. But like I said, I'll give it a try and see if it works, and I'll let you guys know. But you might want to try that in your training if you're looking for something different. On my YouTube channel, I have posted last week's interview with Tom Terwilliger and Tony Pearson and Phil Williams. So I've got now both part one and part two up there. So check that out if you're on YouTube. It's under my name, John Hansen. And I've got a lot of clips on there, especially from Tony posing with the mixed pairs world championships. So check that out. It was pretty good. It took me a while to put them together, as it always does, but it turned out good. So check that out. And I've got some other contest clips on there. I've got the 1982 prejudging for the Mr. Olympia on there. The first round, the symmetry round. So check that out as well. That's getting a lot of views. All right. We did not get any emails this week. What happened with you guys? No emails. So if you're interested in emailing me, do it at naturalolympia@gmail.com, of course. All right. Without any further ado, here is our interview with Eddie Robinson and Franco Santoriello. We bring back the reunion of these guys who were bitter rivals back in the 1980s. Here we go.
All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have two legends with me today. They were great teenage champions, and they both went on to become professional IFBB bodybuilders. First, we have Franco Santoriello. Franco was a great teenage champion. Franco, what did you win to get your pro card? You won your class at the Nationals, right?
I tried to get my pro card in 1988, but somebody decided to go down a weight class and get shredded and kick my butt. So I had to wait till 89, and I won the men's Nationals in 89.
That's right. Okay.
Yeah. Frank almost had me just by a smidgen. Almost had me.
You know, I came to that show. I was like, I'm going to get it this year, you know. And then this son of a gun shows up, shredded out of the glutes. I was like, what the heck? I gave him my best shot, though.
You got it, brother.
That was very good thinking on your part, Eddie. Like, if you forced yourself to get down to light heavy, you knew the condition was going to be there.
Well, you know, it was kind of scary, you know, because I was dialed in right where I wanted to be. You know, I came that shot. I had to get down to what was the cutoff? 197?
198.
Yeah. So I came in there. When I came in that show, I was about, I think it was like 208 pounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
that's when I seen you in the weigh-in. We had a two-day weigh-in.
Yeah.
And Frank made that one comment that just chapped my ass. He said, you're lucky you're not in my class.
Did I say that?
Not in my class. And I said, I'm going to do a late weigh-in. Back then, the stairs, I had a big fat pinch of Copenhagen in, man. I sat in the sauna. I was just destined I weighed in at 100, what was it, 99 pounds. I kept getting on that scale. And finally, the next day, we had that weigh-in, the next weigh-in. And that's when I finally got my weight dialed in. And I tell you what, if you're weighing in, I can barely walk on that scale. I was in a bad shape, man.
I bet you after you weighed in, you were like, give me some food.
Oh, you know it, man.
Liquids, too. You were probably so dehydrated.
Well, the thing is, Twin Labs was there with their Ultra Fuel. And I remember over there said, hey, can I have, he goes, yeah, take what you want. I remember taking one of those big Ultra Fuel containers and I poured it a gallon of water and I just chugged it. I didn't
care. The whole thing?
Oh, no, I took about a quarter of it, you know, because that was a canister. And man, I tell you what, man, veins were popping in my head. My body was just hydrated. But no, I just have dialed in. I couldn't spill over. There's no way. I was so depleted.
Yeah, you were so tight. That was good. That
was funny, and that show was amazing. It was a crazy show. I tell you what.
Yeah, we had some shots.
You know, there's a lot of top pros there. So just being on. I think that was one of the best USAs ever. I mean, Joshua.
It was. And then my class when I got my pro card in 1989. I was up against Al Q Gurley, Porter Cottrell, Flex Wheeler.
Wow.
Gus was in there. Oh, my gosh. But you know what?
When you look at those contests from the 80s and 90s.
Because I just been around. They're like, let's get this guy out of here. Give him his broken. Because I tell you, Al Q Gurley and Porter, they were in good shape that day. But I think I had the physique, the symmetry, and I had the mass. And I was conditioned enough to pull it off. But it was a tough show.
Yeah, yeah.
You always came in, you know, conditioned. You were always. I'm gonna let my dog out real quick. You were always conditioned, so you're a threat to anybody. You know, that was the thing.
Yeah. Thank you. Where are you at? What room are you in right there?
That's my trophy room right here.
Yeah, look at that. Yeah, that's nice. I seen it on Facebook before.
I'm thinking a good run. Well, here's I'm on Tampa Bay, so I'll give you a quick, really quick. I know we're got limited here, but. I'm on Tampa Bay. I'm on the finger, so this is just the inlet here. But
gosh, that's so gorgeous.
Here's the office. I don't know if you can see it real good, but you know, I got all the stuff up here, and I'm surprised I got a picture of you, Franco, around here somewhere.
Do you?
You know what? I have it right up there. I don't know if you can see it there. See the USA up there?
Yeah.
And the trophy, and they handed me the trophy. You're up there. Right?
That's a beautiful room. Yeah, that's a beautiful place you got there.
This is a good span. And of course, it got the covers.
Yeah, I've seen that before. What's really sad, because of my addiction, all my trophies and everything that I've ever won, all my stuff, it's all gone because in my addiction, I had put everything in a storage unit when we moved and we never paid for it and I lost everything. But you know what, today that stuff's nice, but it's more the internal gifts that we have that mean, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
But that's a nice room you got there, Eddie. I admire that.
I appreciate it. Yeah, I got rid of all the trophies are sitting in all the gyms, the local gyms. I didn't want the trophy, but I kept all my statues, you know?
Yeah.
I had all the world record stuff up there, you know, for my world records and all my world arm wrestling champion stuff up here. So, you know, I come to the room, you know, sometimes I get discouraged and I'm like, you know, it just brings me back to life of the things that I've done in my past, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and then when my body, I come in this room, my body starts hurting though when I look man, I remember that. I remember that tear. I remember that rip.
Yeah, right. All that weight, right?
You know, hey, Eddie, your life's not over yet, buddy. You can still make a difference in this world, brother. You know that.
You know that, brother.
A believer too, bro. So you know, people listen, follow you, and they look to you. So you know, be that light, bro. Be that light.
Oh, you got it right, brother. You know, it's just another chapter. This is just a chapter of the past, but it's good.
Yeah,
back in reminisce. It's great seeing you, especially at our age right now.
Oh my gosh, I couldn't wait to see you. I'm glad we're talking because there's been so many times I wanted to call you and just talk to you, like pray with you and stuff, but I never really did. But I'm glad that we're able to. How are you doing, man, physically? Like, I know you've been through a lot.
Well, you know, my story, and Don, I hate to catch you out here, man, because, you know, we're here to shooting the jaw here. But, you know,
no, go ahead, guys.
2018, I think Don just did an interview with me about a year prior to my training. I was actually ready for the NABBA Universe. I wanted to do the Masters.
Yeah. And, what year was that, Eddie?
That was 2018.
18. Yeah, Pearl told me. You're making a comeback.
Yeah. My weight was about 245, 250. I was going to bring it down. I was trying to hit the stage around 228.
Okay.
I was bringing it down, and I also was powerlifting a lot then. You know, I had my bench. I was benching over six. I think I did a 675, 650. I got a couple pictures doing 668, something like that.
Holy shit.
But, I was going to also go for the world record again in the Masters bench. So I was preparing for that, and also I wanted to world championship in arm wrestling. So those are the old things I did, but I wanted to go to the Masters.
Yeah.
So what happened in 2000 was July 22nd, 2018. You know, I was pretty much dialing it in October, November was the universe. I was just dialing it in. And so there was a dog in the gym, and I was at the counter texting one of my clients, stepped back, tripped over the dog, got tangled on my legs. And it was like a run, because when I would trip over, I was trying to catch my balance. I'd like to four, five running steps and dove my trip, and my head went right into wooden lockers. And I woke up pretty much in the hospital, totally destroyed my cervical, you know, C2, 3, 5, 6, and 7, total cage in my neck, destroyed my shoulder, lower back, and jammed my knee into my hip. So I had 7 surgeries to this date. Full hip replacement done. We're going 8 months ago. Had shoulder totally redone. And of course, I got a full cage in my necks. Ended up going to the hospital. The thing is, when I got to the hospital, I kind of vaguely remember what happened. And I couldn't move my legs. I was paralyzed. I was scheduled for emergency surgery. That's when I had to take the C2 and 3 disc out of my spinal cord. So I remember when they were wheeling me in there, I heard somebody say, "Hey, we're going to prepare for trach." I go, "What trach?" You know, when they do that stuff, you know, it's bad.
Yeah.
That C2 and 3 disc in that cervical, of course, it's that phrenic nerve. That phrenic nerve controls the diaphragm to breathe. So I was having difficulty breathing. That's why they're going to do that. So long story short, I had the surgery done, and hey, I'm fine now, thank God. But you know, I could be sitting paralyzed on a breathing machine, be honest with you. But
how's the nerve pain, Eddie?
You know, I'm still dealing with chronic pain, you know.
Yeah.
From the whole neck issue. And there's really nothing, you can't burn. The nerves are so high up, you can't burn them out. Sometimes you get lower nerves, they can burn them. So you don't have that feeling that they're high up. So I got problems in my hands still, a little atrophy in the chest yet, but I'm still giving it hell. You know, it's not stopping me. I train through the pain, but.
You're training again now?
What's that?
You're training again now? You're able to train?
Well, I'm in the gym 5 days a week. You know, probably 35%. But right now it's just maintenance, you know, maintaining, you know, my body right now, I just weighed about 238, 240. So, you know, I'm ripped. You know, I got like 2 abs. So,
Wow.
But you weren't able to train for a while, right? When this happened,
I was down for a full year.
Year. Okay.
I saw.
What's that?
You were posting all that on Facebook. I saw all your surgeries and everything you were going to.
It was hard.
I was feeling for you. I was praying for you, too.
I'm glad you're back in the gym, Eddie.
That's what I do about 5 days a week for maintenance. You know, I just try to stay in shape for my mind.
Exactly.
I have my father was bipolar, and I inherited that same crap stuff. But he committed suicide. So for me, part of my medication is I got to work out. Just to keep my body, and my mind stable.
Exactly.
Franco, you just had a cancer scare, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Back in October. I went to my doctor April before that, like April of last year. I thought I had a swollen gland. I went in there. I said, "Hey, doc," because my doc, he's a Christian. I said, "Hey, doc, give me some antibiotics. I got a swollen gland in my neck." He's like, "All right," wrote me a prescription. And that, you know, when you take them, they tell you got to take it exactly as prescribed. Don't miss a dose.
Right.
steroid pack a thing of antibiotics. I don't know what it is. But I think I missed a dose or maybe two. So I thought, oh, man, that's why it wasn't going away. So I just kind of blew it off for a couple months. And then a few months later, I'm like, man, this thing's still here. And it looks like it's growing. You know, it's massive. I went to back to the doctors. He goes, you need to get that looked at. So I went to the guy to look at from a friend of mine who's a sports doctor. He did a sonogram and he said, you need to go see an ear, throat, and nose specialist. And 3 weeks later, I was in surgery for 5 hours with two surgeons, came out of it in ICU for 3 days with tubes coming out of every hole in my body. It was horrible.
So it was cancer of what, Franco?
Yeah, it's called HPV.
HPV. Okay, I heard of that. Yeah.
Over virus or something. Same thing Michael Douglas got.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's from me being wild when I was young, running around.
Same thing with Michael Douglas, right?
Yeah. we're good. I just went back for my first PET scan, and it came out. You know, everything was all great, and clean. Okay. So I gotta stay out for a few years and then get my report that I'm clean. So ain't no devil taking me out with cancer.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, I've had massive heart attacks. I had the Widowmaker heart attack 11 years ago. I was dead.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know if you ever knew that story, but yeah, I had my son. He was about 8, I guess. So he's 21. So it was really like 13 years ago, I guess. 12 or 13 years ago. Maybe it was 9. But this is at a point in my life, too, again, where I was at a very low, low, low. We were in poverty, homeless, pretty much living in a travel lodge, me and my ex-wife and my son at the time, and she was out doing business somewhere, so it was just me and him that weekend, slept there, and I went to bed that night, woke up in surgery with doctors, and I'm like, what the heck happened? I go, did I have a heart attack? And they said, no, you're having one. What happened when I went to bed that night, in the morning time, I had the heart attack in my sleep, and my son saw me foaming at the mouth, so he tried to wake me up. He couldn't, and then he was smart enough, thank God, he called the desk where we were staying. He's like, my dad, something's wrong. So they came running down and did CPR, and he called 911. When they got there, the paramedics, I was dead. They started to treat me because we were staying in a travel lodge, like where there's a lot of drugs, so they were treating a heroin overdose. They kept hitting me with Narcan, and I wouldn't come back to life. They're like, well, this guy's dead. They got a body bag out to put me in it. Jeez. I was that dead.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. But what happened, I don't know the whole story. I just kind of say it like this when I tell the story and I give my testimony. I just say, I tell people, I said, I think God tapped the guy on the shoulder and said, I'm not done with him yet. Can you use the defibrillator instead of Narcan? Defibrillator got a heart rate. Oh, my gosh, he's alive. And then they brought me to the hospital and stented me up. But I was clinically dead from that. And then at 30 years old, I was clinically dead from a heroin overdose. I've been dead more times than a cat.
Unbelievable.
But I'm here alive, living good, healthy, clean.
Yeah.
Got a new job now, career. I'm doing outside sales, doing really good at it. You know what I mean?
What are you selling for?
A home improvement. Wet space and windows and remodeling kitchens and stuff like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess just because I love people so much. So, you know, I go in the home, I just love on them and show them a great product. And most of the time they buy it.
Sounds great.
Yeah. So when did you guys first meet? What show was it that you first
met? I know when I first met Eddie in person was in that dang sauna. You remember Eddie?
Was that was that the day of the USA? Was that
USA? I went down to get in the sauna. And you were there. No, I don't know if you were already in it.
Yeah, I was out to beat your ass because I was trying to drop that weight.
Yeah, in the sauna, sweating. And I remember I came in. I remember Lou Zwick told me about you. He's like, look out for this guy, Eddie Robinson. He's really like, you know, he's tough, Franco. I'm like, okay. So I remember I got down and I walked in. And you know what's crazy, Eddie, is on my whole way down to that show, from the time I got on the airplane in New Jersey, flew to DeLand, Florida, Daytona, Florida, and drove my car, dad's car, down to Miami, is where it was in Miami, right?
Yeah. Right.
I snorted an 8-ball of cocaine the whole way. Oh, my. So me and my girlfriend, so when I got to the hotel, I was wired out of my butt. So I was like, oh, I got to come down from this. So I ordered like 5 pina coladas. And I goggled them. And then all of a sudden, because I was so depleted and dehydrated from all that cocaine,
yeah.
I ate that alcohol. I went boom, veins everywhere. I was like, yeah. I went down to, I got a little buzz. I went down to the sauna and I saw Eddie. I'm like, oh, poop, who's this guy?
Yeah, I had similar, my similar stories after that sauna when I finally made my weight. I went home and I got me a, I ordered a pitcher of Bud Light and I think I went through a can of Copenhagen. My story was just a little bit different from me. Yeah.
Not an 8-ball of Coke. Now, when did you guys weigh in for that show, Eddie? Was it the day before? Because I know they did things differently in the 80s, right? They got the check-in and stuff the day before, but
I forget what it was so vague. I think it was the day before you can weigh in and then the day of.
Okay.
I can't open early weighing because I didn't care. I really didn't care what my weight was. Right. I know it was heavyweight, and my thing was just dialing in and just watching the water weight. And I was, when I stopped the plane in Miami, I was on the money. I was like, don't drop anything. I think it was about I don't know. I think about, I was at 2.9, 2.13 in between there.
Holy cow. And
on the money. Then, of course, Franco made that comment, just turned my head around saying, you know what? Maybe it's best for me just come in the top of the light heavy instead of the heavyweight, you know?
Because
I looked at heavyweight. I go, I have these heavyweights. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
But the light heavy was a pretty tough class. I said, shit, I'll just drop that weight in and come in right at the top. And when Franco, you know, he had that cocky look on his face, you know, and he looked great. He looked great. You know, you can see when you're cocky, you know, you're in good shape like that, you're going to take care of everybody. So when he said, when I weighed in, he goes, yeah, you're lucky you're not in my class. And I'm like, okay. Off to the sauna I went. Of course, Franco's in the sauna too. He didn't need to lose any weight. He was dialed. He was right on the money. But I was destined to get in that weight class, and I did it. I dropped it. So that's the gimmick on that.
So you got down to 198, and then how much did you go back up before you went on stage? Oh,
I want to tell you something. When I weighed in after the show, after the night show, I was hit. I was about I want to say the I don't know what the scale was in the gym at there. I don't know. After the show, I was probably about two. I think it was 215, something like that. But I was chugging the water and just monitoring and taking in some sugars in the back when I was pumping up, especially the night show, just monitoring. And I just filled up and just bloomed, man. I was just ready to rip. You can hold that peak for it's only so long when you start pounding that water. And you
have had to take out Johnny Morant, right, in the heavies?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Johnny was a freak. Johnny has the potential to kill any. He scared me. Thing was, he came a little soft, thank God.
Yeah.
You know, eyeball on Johnny. I'm looking at him. I'm like, oh my God, this guy's huge.
Yeah.
He had them biceps.
Yeah. Everything.
Everything.
The chest of Johnny, man, was just everything about Johnny was huge. He had huge legs, chest. He just wasn't gripped enough, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, man, me and Johnny were workout partners for that show.
Oh, that's right. New Jersey, right?
Trained together a lot for that show. When I could chase him down, he was always chasing girls. He was chasing girls.
me and Johnny were pretty tight during the WBF days. We were really close. Right.
I was telling my wife about that when you turned pro, you went to the WBF. It was like for 3 years or something.
Well, the WBF lasted for 2 years, but the contest, but I stayed on for four because I signed on with the ICAPRO, which is the conditioning program that Fred Hatfield came on with. Mm-hmm. And I product ICAPRO. So I stayed on for an extra 2 years. So I got a 4-year contract where everybody else got two.
Nice.
And it was kind of rough because that was my first Olympia there in 1990, and I was just head top on that because I won my first pro show, did pretty good in the Olympia. And then I'm like, I get a call from Vince McMahon saying, hey, I'm doing another federation. What would it take for you to come aboard? And I'm like, what will it take? I'm like, I'm not going anywhere. New federation. I just got my pro card, man. I'm heading to the top.
Right. I want to hear the story. Go ahead.
Yeah. And he goes, well, give me a number. So I go, okay. He's a rich guy. I threw him a number I threw him a number. I'm like, pants. And he said, okay. I'm like, are you kidding me? I should have went higher. But I gave him a stupid number, you know? And and I signed that contract for, I didn't do a 2 year. I did a 4 year because he wanted me to sign for ICAPRO, which was a totally different contract on that too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, I think you were you the Cybergenics guy that time?
Yeah, I was Cybergenics. I did the Cybergenics stuff. I ran with them for 7 years. They paid me.
7 years. Wow. Yeah. You were famous from that, Franco.
Yeah, I'll tell you, that's one thing Cybergenics did for me. It made me world famous.
Yeah, you're on ESPN all the time.
Fire in the world.
Right.
In my book, I wrote a book, you guys know, in my book in chapter 6, it's called Sellout, how I sold out to Perillo and did the Cybergenics thing. I tell the story how that affected my inner being. Yeah. You know, it really messed me up, you know, when I did that. But John didn't have a company. You know what I mean? And I was just turned pro and I was a drug addict and I needed money.
Yeah.
So, you know, this company comes along and they offered me a bunch of money. And the crazy thing was the day after I signed my Cybergenics contract, I get a call from John's lawyer telling me, oh yeah, John's got a supplement company. He wants you to be his spokesperson. I said, what? Because like he was keeping it a secret from me. Like, it wanted to surprise me. I'm like, oh, yeah, you're a surprise.
Yeah, he surprised you.
Yeah, surprise. But I started crying and bawling. I couldn't believe what happened. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this, what just happened. I would have, even his money was, it was a lot less than what they were giving me, but I would have ran to that just to be with John. And it probably would have did a lot better because he would have kept me aligned.
That
was the worst. I started partying so much. I used a lot of drugs during that time.
Now, you guys were both great teenage champions. I thought you competed as teenagers. Did you know each other as teenagers?
Yeah, no, we competed as teenagers. That's what I started talking about when I went down to Miami. Then Eddie got back to the men's.
Okay.
Yeah, we competed in the light heavyweight class in the 84 Team USA.
Okay. Right. All right.
Remember that, Eddie?
I do. I won that one. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think I have right here, the plaque on the wall right here.
When you won the Teenage USA?
Teenage USA, yeah. And I had to look right and see what I had. I think I had something right under that Teen USA. Yeah.
I think I won the overall, though, didn't I?
Yeah, you won the overall, Franco. Eddie won the light heavies. I'm looking at it.
Yeah. Right.
And then Eddie came and kicked my butt when we became men.
So the rivalry started in 84 then, right? When you guys were teenagers.
Yeah, I feel that rivalry was really just mostly fun. I mean, I think Zwick started it. He's like, you guys should like go at each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, you always got to have a rivalry. They did the same thing with me and Sean Ray when I won the Junior Nationals, you know?
Yeah.
I always love rubbing that in Sean's face, you know?
right.
You know, with me. I didn't get to step on Olympia with Sean really because I left in 90 and went and made some money because the money was more important to me than getting a plaque or getting a trophy or whatever. Because I was never going to win the Olympia. I didn't have the body, the size to do that. Mm-hmm. And I was way too pretty to win the Olympia. So I just made my money off the covers. I went where the money was, you know.
Right.
You know, the best thing about signing with the WBF, of course, was I also had a Weider contract for Weider Publication.
Yeah.
And my other contract, there was loopholes all over it, which didn't affect my competing with the WBF.
Really? No kidding.
Joe hated that.
Wow.
You know, because I was able, because I had a 4 year with Joe also.
Hmm. So how were you able to do that, Eddie? Was it just like a magazine contract or a modeling contract?
It was my contract was for the publications of Muscle and Fitness.
Okay. So not the IFBB. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So at the end of my year, I was going to re-sign with the ICAPRO and Joe bought my contract out. That's when I had all the controversy with Wayne D'Amelio. And then I didn't have a chance in hell to win or even place. They wouldn't even call me out when I came back because they're giving me a little spanky from the effect of the WBF.
Right.
But I didn't care. Joe said, just get in the best shape of your life, and I'm going to put you on every cover and every spread. And that's what I did. You know, I got 87 covers, you know, and that's what made my money. You know, magazines say, hey, what do you want for, a cover? I said, get $25,000 or forget about it. And, you know, when you're more popular, you can name your own price.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Isn't it amazing how bodybuilding and the world has changed so much, where the magazines were so big back then, and
oh,
now
yeah.
it's all gone, you know?
They don't even have magazines anymore, no. do they?
They might
they
have.
Don't even, no. You know, the last time I seen them on a magazine rack by the right. by the checkout, they had a plastic thing over top of it where you couldn't see it, which was, I'm like, why?
Really?
Why'd they do that? And the reason they did that is that they, I asked the cashier, I go, why is there a plastic thing over top? They use, because you're showing too much body. I'm like, are you kidding me?
This is today, right now?
No, this was a while back. Nowadays, okay. you can't even find the publications.
No, I never see any.
My mom and my grandma used to call me and say, hey, I seen you at the register in Muscle Fitness and Flex, which was great. That was the best thing to be on the cover, is having your grandparents right. and your mom right. picking up issues telling you to cover, right. you know? That was better than actually being on it, just to, for them to be so proud of what you're doing.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
now, you know, I had a talk with Joe. It just takes me back when I retired, you know, back in 2002. When Joe, I sat down with Joe, and Joe said, hey, you know, I'm selling the publications. And I go, what? You know, I'm done. I'm selling to David Peck with AMI. And he got a great deal on selling them. I go, why? He said, because it's going down the tubes. I mean, I can't. My covers aren't selling anymore.
Wow.
The buyer has made a big change. He's getting out what he getting was good, and he sold out. He called it because, in all honesty, the Olympians, the athletes were getting way too big. They weren't marketable anymore. People were not buying the publications because that right. sex appeal wasn't there.
Right.
You know, the Bob Parises, the Barry DeMays, the Lila Bradas, all these great physiques that were polished and looked beautiful, but only 175 pounds, they're gone. There's all mutants, freaking yeah. huge freaks.
Yeah,
and right. that, my friend, ruined the sport. And today, oh, forget about it. You know, I'm appalled at the. I hate to say this, you know, it's a bodybuilding show and all this, but the sport is like, I don't even. I get tickets all the time sent to me for the Olympia. I don't even go. I just don't care to see the mutants. Yeah. It's like, I'm saddened yeah. watching all these great athletes dying lately. I mean, the last yeah. 2 years, horrendous. I mean, and these young kids you don't hear about. You know,
I know, and I'm
talking to these trainers, man. They're on, you know, all these different peptides, GH, insulin. I mean, oh my God! I'm like, are you serious?
Yeah.
What are you getting paid for this? Nothing. They're not even getting paid.
Right. I mean, you were just saying how much did you make for a magazine cover? 25.
Well, I remember Bob Kennedy was, because I had Robert Kennedy, but I made him pay 25 because I had a little problem with him a lot of times. But,
okay.
you know, with a lot of the issues, I'd ask 20, 25. Depends if I had a inside spread, do 5 or 6 pages inside and the cover. It depended yeah. on, you know, what they all wanted, you know.
Yeah. That's amazing there, Kennedy, because if you look at today, I hear today's competitors, and they'll do a photo shoot. They pay the photographer to get photos of them done, but there's no more magazines. So there's really no, it's not like it was before where, you know, the Joe Weider or Bob Kennedy is paying a photographer to film you and then they pay you money to do it, you know?
So the athletes got to pay to be on the cover.
Yeah. There's no covers anymore. I mean, they're just paying photographers gotcha. To take do photo shoots and then they just have pictures for themselves, I guess, for Instagram or whatever, but it's the whole marketing part is gone, you know?
But, you know, get this. No, Franco, back in our day, of course, we had to bust our ass. And there was guys in that USA that's been there 4, 5, 6 times trying to win that pro card.
Yeah.
There's only 2 to 3 pro cards handed out a year.
Yeah.
Yeah, when we compete.
Now there's like 400. And why? Know. Why is there? Why is there 400 now given out a year? Because you also have to pay to be a pro athlete.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Are you freaking lost your freaking mind? Who pays to be a pro?
Money off of those competitions today. I know. I just went to a show. A girl went in like 4 or 5 different classes and paid $200 to go in each class.
Yeah.
It's $1,000 just to go compete.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we competed, they gave away the overall USA and each weight class in the nationals and the North America overall got a pro card. And that was it. They gave away 6 pro cards a year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then the lightweight, bantamweight guys, they never did nothing. You know what I mean? It was like middleweights. Sometimes they would move up and make it into the pros, but it was always the light heavyweights and heavyweights that really did it. And then sometimes you got a middleweight that would grow into his physique.
Yeah.
But those, so really only 4 guys were turning pro a year that was competing.
Yeah, right. You know? When you guys were teenagers, were you looking at turning pro? I mean, you were both really genetically gifted. You were
competed at 15 years old, and I went my first bodybuilding show. There was 21 guys, and I was 15, and I took second. That day, I said, I'm going to be Mr. Teenage USA. And then when I went to Teenage USA Nationals, I said, I'm going to be a pro. But my problem was there was so much drugs in my life. You know what I mean? I couldn't do nothing. Bodybuilding, and I would go on binge and not train and do drugs for a year and come back and make a comeback.
Yeah.
And when I was making a comeback, I was still using. I was just smoking a lot of pot, drinking alcohol, and doing coke. I mean, I just wasn't doing, you know, so. But I don't regret nothing. You know what I mean? It's good today. I'm blessed with a beautiful family and I'm alive, thank God, after all the death experiences.
Yeah.
You know, life is good that I get to still do a lot of work for the Lord. You know, I do any chance I get to do ministry work, I'm still doing that. And I love to do that. You know what I mean? Yeah. I love sharing, you know, what the God's done in my life for me with other people. Because my life, you know, there's a lot of, you know, I can identify with convicts and drug addicts and stuff like that. Not like Eddie. I mean, he didn't go that route, but I did. You know what I mean? So I have that avenue now. Cancer patients, I could, you know, be a witness to and stuff. How God got me through all those times and mental illness and all that because I was hospitalized for suicide.
Yeah.
Not today though. 11 years clean.
Yeah. Great.
I'm blessed, man.
Hey Franco, tell that story when you did the one contest. It was the Teenage USA, and then you won your class, and then you were competing against Sean Ray, and you took like the whole summer. You were partying. Tell that one.
Oh yeah. So me and Eddie just competed. And I just won the USA.
Okay.
Okay. So I said, okay, I think I had like 14 weeks to the team nationals. So I went back to the Jersey Shore. I said, okay, I'm going to take a break. I'm going to party for 3 days, get crazy. And my 3 days turned into 8 weeks. I didn't work out for 8 weeks. I lit every 7 nights a week. Me and my brother went down to the Jersey Shore and we had a motto. We were either going to meet girls or get in a fight. That was our life for the summer. We were crazy. So, Zwick is calling me every week asking me how I'm doing. I'm saying, oh, I'm doing great. And he said,
not even training.
I'm lying to him. Finally, it's like 7 weeks to the show. And he said, how are you doing? I'm like, I started crying. I'm like, Lou, I'm lying to you. I've been lying. I haven't worked out. He's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, I haven't worked out, Lou. I go, I've been partying. And he goes, really? I'm like, yeah. I goes, there's no way I could go into Team Nationals and win. There's no way possible.
So how many weeks did you have left?
I had 7 weeks. He said, hold on a minute, I'll call you back. And he called up Perillo and he said, hey, I'm going to send this kid out to you. You got to train him for 7 weeks. I think you could get him back in shape. I went out to Perillo. 7 weeks later, I got on stage with Sean Ray and beat him after taking an 8-week break.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's how you met John Perillo, right?
That's how I met John Perillo, yeah.
Yeah.
I still see John. He lives right by me, not far.
Oh, really?
His office is 20 minutes from my house.
Oh, that's awesome. How old is John now?
Here, if I take you, look at this, I'll show you this. So I'm just going to take you over to my cabinet in my house and down here. Look, we still got Perillo Performance. See it?
Oh, yeah.
Tap try. I still take his stuff. Yeah, it's good supplements.
Yeah, yeah.
He charges me, though, that cheap sound of guy. I love him though. He's been through a lot of surgeries too, man. You know, John used to be a power lifter when he was younger and bodybuilder.
Oh, okay.
And he used to power like Eddie used to power lift and bodybuild together.
Yeah.
But then he, you know, John was too smart. He started getting to the engineering of supplements and all that stuff, and he went that route.
Now when you guys turned pro, what was your thinking then? Like you were saying, Eddie, you didn't think you could ever win the Olympia, so you went more the magazines and the money, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Olympia, of course, the reason I say I didn't think I'd win the Olympia is because I took that. I wanted it really bad, of course, in the beginning in 1990 when I hit my first Olympia. And then, you know, when I signed over to Vince McMahon's WBF, I knew it was done because I know what politics.
Yeah.
I know I just burned a huge bridge, not only with Weeders, it's just with D'Amelia and Wayne, and, you know, I didn't want to go all that at the time.
Right.
But I knew damn well I'd be blackballed for the rest of my life. But I also knew I had 4 years. If I banked it, I would have to work for the rest of my damn life. So, I looked at it, where does the scale go? Screw that, Olympia. Yeah. I'm going to make some take care of my family. Take care of my mama, buy me a nice house on the water, and I'm still here on the water. Hell yeah. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, the reason I said never, my mindset was never to win the Olympia. And the reason I say that is because, you know, I hate to bash things and be this, oh yeah, right. But I never wanted to do the insulin and what it took to be on that top. I really didn't. Wasn't going to, and I didn't, you know. My health is perfect, except for the accidents I was in, which was, you know, an accident. But, you know, I didn't want to have enlarged heart and everything else that goes along with the GH and all the freaking insulin and all that shit.
Was that starting already then, Eddie, around that time?
Just starting.
Right then, in the 90s. I mean, you know, I watched, I have some pictures here with Johnny Morant behind me. Not Johnny Morant, but Ronnie Coleman, and he was small, dude.
Yeah.
And I seen Ronnie come back 40 pounds heavier. This is when Dorian took it. Momo passed away the one of my, you know, contests.
Right.
And when I dig into it, what is it? This insulin kept going around. Everybody's doing this insulin. And finally, you know, it broke out. How are these guys getting so huge? Well, they're doing insulin with every meal. They're freaking pumping the GH, and they're getting twice the size from this cocktail.
Right.
And steroids got to be Kool-Aid, and nowadays it's still Kool-Aid. So you got these peptides, you got, and it's just, you know, mutants, man. And so I didn't choose to do that route. And Joe didn't want me to do that route either. He said, don't do it, because I need you to sell publications. I need you to be my moneymaker.
Yeah.
And I didn't do that. So that's why I got 85, 87 covers. And I was just blasting every publication.
Yeah.
And when I did every publication, it made me in demand to all the foreign publications, you know, foreign, you know, I said, hey, you know, banking the money, charging them for the covers and the photo shoot, because every photo shoot I did, I wouldn't sign a release unless I had the rights to use every one of those photos for my own personal. And I also told Joe he has 24 months to use those photos, and it was dead. Now he paid me extra money. So that's why I didn't see any other, you know, no of these other bodybuilders, they take these photos and they'll sell them to anybody. There's nothing they can do because they have the rights to it. It's crazy.
Right.
No one can use my photo because I make sure that I have the rights to those photos. That's me. You know, because once you do a photo shoot, you sign that release, they can sell it to every nutrition company, put you on a label, and there's nothing you can do about it.
So your deal with Weider, was it just a contract where he could just do as many photo shoots as he wanted, or were you getting paid for each shoot?
He pretty much paid my contract for Muscle Fitness and Flex, and Weider Nutrition was basically to represent the publication and nutrition.
Okay.
So I shot for the publications constantly, but I also said that, hey, you know, my contract's up. You're not using my photos ever again. Because that's why I would write on the contract when this is only for a 20, whatever was left on my contract. Like if there was 8 months left on my contract and I did a photo shoot with Chris Lund or Robert Reeve or Bill Dobbs, whoever it may be, I'd write on there, these photos are dead in 8 months when my contract's up and will not be able to use unless the consent of Edward Robinson, blah, blah, blah. I always wrote that at the bottom in all my things. And if they said no, I said, I'll go home. I'm done.
Okay.
So they couldn't use any of these photos. And of course, when my contract was up, they re-signed me because I knew they couldn't keep the library of photos I had because they were dead. They couldn't use them. Go ahead and use them. Last person who used my photo cost them $200,000 without my permission.
Wow.
It would have been $1 million, but they settled out of court because they knew I would have got that $1 million. So use my photo, baby. Use it. Don't let me catch you. Don't let me catch you.
That's a great idea. How about you, Franco? When you turned pro in 89, were you looking at, you know, I want to go into the Mr. Olympia, I want to be a top pro? What was your thoughts?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was my heart. That was my dream to go to the Olympia and win it. But, you know, there was something stopping me. You know, I had Satan had a grip on me, brother. I couldn't do it. You know, I mean, I had dreams to do it, but my addiction just didn't allow it. You can't be a great pro bodybuilder when you're a drug addict.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? When we talk about the juice, I told you, John, I barely even ever did steroids. Remember?
Yeah.
I built my physique off of hard work and good nutrition. I'm not going to say I didn't do them, but I didn't do a lot of them because I told you, remember? I would get GH and I would get steroids and sell it and go get coke.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. It's whatever.
It's amazing the physique you built. It's amazing the physique you built, you know, with that addiction. It's incredible.
God gave me some good genetics, that's for sure.
Yeah, because like you said, the competition back then was unbelievable. I look at some of those contests from the 1980s. Yeah. It's so deep. Every lineup is so deep.
Oh, yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. So, Franco, what do you think? What do you think about bodybuilding today? Like Eddie was talking.
Oh, just exactly what Eddie said, man. I'm just going to ditto what he said.
Yeah.
Eddie said, I reiterate all of it. It really kind of disgusts me, honestly. But it's what it is. I mean, I don't even understand how it's a sport. It's more not. It's like a chemistry experiment. You know what I mean? Yeah. Hey, look at him. Ah!
My new pit bull, Finn. Say hi, Finn. He's Finn. He's 15 weeks old. He's about 30.
He's like a puppy.
He's my new pity.
Yeah.
And his first time he's ever on a bodybuilding show.
There you go. He's a star now.
Yeah.
So question for you, Franco. If you've seen bodybuilding today and we were teenagers again, and you look at all these bodybuilders, would you want to be a pro today?
No.
Absolutely not, right?
No.
Yeah.
It's what there's no beauty.
You know? I remember looking at like Frank Zane and, you know, guys like, you know, Samir Banute.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's what I looked. I remember.
Yeah, some of the bodybuilders today look at those guys. They say they were too skinny and they don't understand how they won Mr. Olympia. And, you know, they don't understand how great those guys were.
We're too skinny?
No, like Frank Zane, Samir, they look at them and they're like, how did this guy ever win Mr. Olympia? They don't understand the beauty of
his physique.
Yeah.
Yeah, but have one of them do a vacuum pose like Frank Zane and let's see who looks the best. You know what I'm saying? Can anybody do a Franco Zane? I think most of them are Franco, aren't they? I mean, when I got into 19, when I started to come back to the IFBB, you know, I looked down the lineup and, man, everybody was freaking pregnant. And if I were to look like that in the beginning of my career, I would not place. But during that time, you didn't place not unless you were Prego. It was like crazy.
Yeah.
And watch these guys walk the center stage. They're huffing and puffing just to get to that X, man. I'm like, is this a healthy sport?
Yeah.
I mean,
I remember being at a show with a bodybuilder. You remember Paul DeWitt?
Paul DeWitt?
But DeWitt. I remember being at a show with him, and he was just like, he couldn't breathe.
Frankenstein, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, man, what's wrong with this guy?
Yeah.
He couldn't get breath.
Yeah, I think he had asthma too, though.
He did,
He had a bad asthma problem, so,
That's what it was. I was like, wow, the poor guy can't breathe.
Who were the guys that inspired you when you guys were younger, when you were, like, teenagers? Who were the bodybuilders that inspired you?
When I was a teenager?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Franco inspired me.
Eddie inspired me.
I just wanted to beat his ass. And he wanted to beat my ass.
I couldn't wait. I tell people, I said, I'm doing an interview with Eddie Robinson, and we're going to have some fun.
Yeah. You know, I loved everybody in the sport because everybody had their physique that I liked. You know, everybody loved Tom Plass's legs. Everybody loved back and biceps. And Bertel Fox was so freaking huge. And I mean, I on and on about every athlete that they were just phenomenal because they were all different and had that special look.
Right. You know? Yeah. Right. Right.
So, you know, Frank Zane was like crazy ripped and just had just such flowing symmetry and beauty to his body, and I think he was the only one to really beat Arnold out in Olympia, wasn't it?
Yeah, at the universe, yeah.
Right. So, you know, and even when Haney was competing against Lee Labrada, I mean, two different physiques, and it looked so great to see a guy that weighed 235, 40 pounds and a guy at 175 or whatever Lee Labrada was at first and second place. And that's what I want to see is the little guy and the big guy. You don't have to be the big guy to win. Today's all cookie cutter, full of oils, full of pumped up. I mean, it's just freaking cookie cutter giant. You turn the light off and put a light behind them and look at all the physiques. It looked like a bunch of refrigerators lined up on stage.
Right.
All the same cookie cutter shape.
Yeah. What do you think of that classic physique? Have you guys seen that new division they have? They're trying to bring back the look. It's called classic physique.
Oh, classic. Yeah, I did see that. That's kind of, you know, that's an interesting thing. I like that.
Yeah.
Classic, like what we used to look like back in the day.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's what they're trying to get. They're trying to recapture that. It's more of the symmetry.
Bodybuilding, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think it's starting to catch on. So I think that was their answer because the guys were getting so big, you know.
Right.
Been a lot of fishing, Eddie?
Yeah, I do. As a matter of fact, I did this morning. I caught two bass this morning out here on the lake. I got right out here in the lake. I got off the seawall. I got this is fresh water and it spills over to Tampa Bay. Okay. But I got like 20, 30, at least 5 to 6 pounders out here every day. So I feed them all my leftovers, rice and stuff. I throw it out there. It's like feeding the fish.
Stick around there, huh?
Yeah, I don't eat them. I'm a catch and release, and I hate watching these guys keep them when they come around because I feed them all the time. They're like my friends, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I go. I fish bass and stuff out here on the lake, and I go across the street in the bay, and I catch, you know, flounder, reds, you know, snook, mm-hmm. and you know, it's long line fun time all the time. Yeah. You know,
now, when you go out there and catch flounder, then you keep that, or you throw them back too?
Oh yeah. Yeah, most of my diet came off this bay. You know, I a lot of snook, a lot of cobia. I go out deep and do a lot of grouper fishing. Refrigerator's full of fish. My son is I call him the snook slayer. He'll catch 3 or 4 a night. He's just a master. The thing is known where they're bedding at. Mm-hmm. You know, so we'll look down at the views from the satellites and see where all the grass beds are and all that stuff. We target them. So, you know, it's all about doing your homework and being smart, you know, and knowing where they're at.
Yeah. There you go.
Are you in Largo, Eddie? Are you still in Largo? Eddie, are you still in Largo?
No, I'm in Safeter Harbor, right on Tampa Harbor. Bay.
Okay.
60 that goes across from the airport, 60 that goes across the bay. I live right off 60, the Courtney Campbell Causeway.
Oh, okay. That's where I live. I live in Tampa on 60, off of 60.
Oh yeah, good deal. Yeah, I'm right across the bay then from you. See, you know where the Safety Harbor Spa is?
Yeah, yeah.
I live right across the street.
Oh, okay. All right, cool.
So I've been here. I mean, after I got my first contract with Weeder, that's why I bought this house. I've been here since 88, 89.
Okay. All right.
So, wow.
Been here a long time.
Oh yeah. Love it.
Frankly, you're still in New Jersey, right?
No, I'm in Ohio.
Oh, you're in Ohio. Okay.
I've really? Been in since I was 35.
Oh, okay. Okay. By Perillo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Found home here.
Well, you know, I was born in Akron, you know that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a Buckeye. Yep. Akron, Canton area. I went to Coventry High School, lived in Portage Lakes. I left there when I got out of high school, 17, 18 years old. That's when I did it down to Florida.
Yeah. You being from Akron, Ohio. Remember that, yeah.
Well, back in Ohio, all you did in wintertime was arm wrestle. So that's why I was a good arm wrestler, you know.
Oh, really?
You know, we drank beer and we arm wrestled. And that's what I did for a living because I make $500 and get a free beer tab. So why would I have to work during the week, you know?
Right.
So we would travel around the pub, just arm wrestling.
Oh, really?
You know, it was what we did back then.
Yeah. Now, are you able to go heavy again, Eddie, after your injuries, or are you just kind of maintaining?
Absolutely not. I mean, I just started squatting last week. I'll go to 315. That's where I'll max out at. I can't go heavy with the new hip I have because I don't want to pop it out. I can feel it, you know, when 315 is my max out doing a squat now.
Yeah.
I mean, we were 675, going up to 800 pounds, doing 400-pound front squats. Yeah, those days are freaking gone. Why, though? Yeah. Why not? You know?
Yeah.
My bench press, like I say, I was doing the high sixes back in 2018. I'm lucky to do 2.25 now. My shoulders won't handle it. The pain I get for 3 or 4 days after is just not worth it.
Is that from the nerves and stuff?
The nerves are, I mean, they're the shot. I mean,
yeah.
I have a lot of problem with the strength because they hang up. I got these dead spots, like on a French curl, or you know, I can't do it. There's a dead spot. It impinges, and I just can't do anything. There's nothing you can do about it. You know. So I just train on what I can do and how heavy I can go and what doesn't hurt. You know.
Okay. Yeah.
Maintaining. I have the same exact training philosophy. Whatever I can do, heavy as I can, and as long as it don't hurt.
Yeah. It doesn't hurt. destroy it.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
All right, guys. Well, I know, Eddie, you got to go to church, so I wanted to thank you guys for joining me. It was great having you two together again, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you guys on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast.
John, great pleasure. Always good talk to you. And Franco, both you guys, I love you guys. Keep doing what you're doing. Franco, I'm going to inbox me. I'm going to give you my number. We need to keep in touch, man, you know?
Okay. Yeah. You got it, buddy.
We'll set the world on fire. Get these people back and following the Lord, man, because
I'm gonna message you and I want to get your number. We're gonna talk because Eddie, we can do a lot for the Lord. I mean, we did a lot for ourselves, but we can do so much for God before we go home. Let's do it.
That's what I want to talk to you about.
Let's talk about that, bro.
So let's go ahead and set the world on fire on our second chapter. You got it?
I'm with
you.
Yeah.
All right, John, stay tuned. All right,
I will. Okay, guys. Right, thank you very much.
Guys. Have a home Sunday.
You too. Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thanks to Eddie Robinson and Franco Santoriello for making the time to come on the show. I really enjoyed talking to those guys, and I think they enjoyed their little reunion with each other again, so that was great. I want to thank all our Patreon donors. You guys are the best. You guys help this show keep going. If you're interested in being a Patreon donor, just go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link for Patreon. If you want to donate some money to the show, just keep it going, hold down the production costs. I really do appreciate you guys. As I said, we could not do this without you. So thank you very much. If you have any emails you want to send me, send it to naturalolympia@gmail.com. And if you guys are interested in any online training, just go to prophysique.com. I have the link listed right here on the below on this podcast. So just check that out. You can click on that link and request me as your coach. All right. Without any further ado, I want to read this article by Rick Wayne, which comes from a 1982 issue of Muscle and Fitness magazine. I'm not sure which issue it was. Probably, I would say April, but I'm guessing because I just got this article offline. I didn't get it from the actual magazine. I do have the magazine somewhere in my collection, but it's still at my parents' house, I think. So, but this is Olympia 81. This is part three. It says 4,000 voices rise in protest and a familiar name is on their lips by Rick Wayne. If the prejudging audience was thirsty for Olympia action, the producers of the contest chose to serve a Diet 7-Up commercial starring TV sugar cake Lonnie Anderson and the charming prince who had turned overnight into a frog, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Bodybuilding's current favorite voodoo doll. The soft drink hard sell, having been accorded equal doses of cheers and booze, the Olympia organizers decided to press their luck still further. Instead of giving their obviously impatient audience what it hungered for, they served another peace offering, this time in the 4-foot-nothing form of Garrett Walsh, a 12-year-old bodybuilding miracle from Ontario. Garrett brought the house to its feet with a display of posing technique that compared favorably with Ed Corney's and Pumping Iron. The kid posed to disco music and never missed a beat. The organizers had gambled on the patience of their audience and come up roses. So now, with impeccable timing, Oscar State brought out the heavy artillery. Fuller, Padilla, Benute, Davis, Platts, Tinerino, Dickerson, Ratty, Metz, Waller, Rodriguez, Wilkosch, Walker, Corney, Colombo, Callender, and Katz. 17 in all. They marched on stage like prime gladiators from a world that had never known defeat, a world where only number one mattered. Never before had a higher caliber of Olympia champions appeared together on one stage. Here was more evidence contrary to the notion that all men are created equal. The audience paid its respects with an ovation loud enough to be heard on the top floor of the Columbus Sheraton a mile or so away. There was a feeling that the audience was also congratulating itself for having been prescient enough to see through the dark prognostication suggesting that second raters alone would participate in the 81 Olympia, if it came off at all. Reg Park stuck his fingers in his mouth and blew a whistle that would have pierced lead. A chorus of highly stimulated females in 10th row center managed to sound exactly like Slim Whitman as they screamed encouragement to Samir Benute. And some diehards from Chicago hollered what came out like, Franco Tre Forte, if there were any in this audience who had come to Columbus expecting a wake
they had now changed into their glad rags. Right from the start, it was clear that whatever quality the contenders for the 81 Olympia title shared, it wasn't brotherly love. Whoever had placed Callender next to Colombo soon had just cause to reevaluate his sanity. For even before the 17-man lineup had settled down, Callender exploded like some overripe giant raspberry all over Colombo. "Look," said Callender, pointing to his extended left leg and the thick crisscrossing bands that suddenly appeared in his tense thigh. "Look." There was a roar of approval as 8,000 dilated eyeballs zoomed in on the chunk of finely carved ebony that Callender had brought up alongside the Sardinian celebrated vulnerable thigh. Callender was serving notice on Colombo that all Franco stood to gain from this contest was a belly full of humble pie. But then Franco had never cared for pastry. "Look," he responded, pointing to the mess of squirming serpents in his pectorals. More whistles, more flailing fists, more screams from the audience of wire pullers. "Look," Callender fired back, pointing to his own strided chest. "Now, how do you like that? And that? And that?" On each "that," a fresh set of muscles jumped to attention, to the delight of the fans. The contest hadn't actually started, but already the walls were crepitating with the heat. From the left end of the lineup, Padilla suddenly stopped forward, then turned and headed toward Colombo and Callender, presumably to join the affray. The move was loudly applauded, but Oscar Stated had his full of anonymity. He barked out a demand for self-control, and the giant killer froze, smiled his little boy smile, and then returned to his place. The audience retaliated with a storm of boo bombs. The seasoned State just smiled his old boy smile. The Olympia had never been a tea party for geriatric war veterans, where you sat legs together, hands on your knees. Oh, no. From the days of Scott, Poole, Draper, and Oliva, it had been a Pier 6 brawl that only the fittest survived. So if during the last 2 or 3 years, some toothless fuddy-duddies had succeeded in slowing down the action to a convenient snail's pace, well, it was time to turn back the clock to an earlier day when there were few restrictions and Olympia fans were free to express themselves as they wished, free to clap, free to cheer, if necessary, Bronx style. In Columbus, the fans were in no mood to tolerate nitpickers who turned blind eyes to matters of importance, but were not above denying Olympia audiences their money's worth. The fans had come determined to restore the Olympia to its glorious past, no matter if on the long march a few toes got trampled. Unknown to the Olympia contenders and their supporters, during the international, Oscar State had found cause to privately declare Mrs. Matayuma unfit to judge. But in deference to her high IFBB position in Japan, she was allowed to keep her seat on the adjudicating panel for the duration of the contest. Indeed, Mrs. Matayuma was allowed to go through the motions of judging the Olympia, even though her scores were never tabulated with the rest of the panels. Her name does not appear on the Olympia score sheets, almost as if she had never sat with Jacques Bloomhart and the other adjudicators. Initially, it was difficult to discern from the reaction of the audience who among the 17 Olympia contenders was the most popular. At first, the crowd seemed to favor Padilla, Colombo, Dickerson, Platts, and Callender, but gradually, audience response to Dickerson and Colombo cooled off. Tinarino was in the best shape of his life. He was well-received, true, but the really wild responses were reserved for others. Wilkosch was not nearly as impressive as he'd been at the pro universe a year earlier. He appeared tired even before the action had heated up. "I had been warned to expect a surprise from Platt, so I should have been ready for what he brought to Columbus. I was not. Oh, his thighs were still beyond adequate description by me, and his calves were, as usual, good enough to challenge the world's best. No surprises there. But this new Platts had now acquired more muscle in his arms, chest, and shoulders, and it changed into something a scream away from unworldly. Precisely, it seems, the look that Olympia fans most appreciate." Yes, the Olympia had never been home to ballet stars. It was a contest that could be won only by men with elephantine proportions, men like Scott and Oliva and Schwarzenegger. And Ferrigno, had not the Incredible Hulk ripped out his bodybuilding guts and turned him into an impersonator. True, Colombo had once been Mr. Olympia, but by then the gargantuans had disappeared, like dinosaurs from the scene. Zane? Yes, he too had been Mr. Olympia, 3 times, while the giant slept. In the absence of cats, mice had ruled. It didn't matter that Platts was still not the most symmetrically built champion in the world. Something in the way the fans reacted to his every movement on stage was clear warning that they fully expected Tom to win. Callender's flaws originated in the mold. To the best of my knowledge, no courses have been formulated that can straighten bull legs, and no amount of stretching will ever lengthen Callender's calves. They begin and end somewhere behind the big fella's knee joints, and methinks that's exactly where you'll find them judgment day. But having got that out of the way, let us now say that in those areas of the physique responsive to torturous exercise, Roy was unbeatable on Olympia day. He displayed tremendous arms, amazing thighs, a tight waist, neatly separated abdominals, and clearly carved intercostals. And it's a toss-up between him and Platts who had the better back in Columbus. The fires of self-confidence burned in Roy's eyes, hot enough to fry eggs. And then there was Colombo. Good as he had been in 76, yes, maybe better, save in the area of his thighs. But something, I don't quite know what, hell, I know, but I won't tell till later. Yes, something in my prejudiced subconscious prevented me from concentrating on Colombo. I turned from him and focused on Padilla, who had transformed himself, especially his face. This Danny had the face of an ailing rodent, so lean that it seemed his skull was barely covered. A look, you may be sure, that spoke of torture in the months preceding the Olympia. Danny's symmetry, of course, was perfect. This time, however, he was ripped at 150 pounds, a good 30 pounds lighter than his normal competition body weight. Finally, he had fulfilled the popular ambition. He had come in cut to shreds while retaining his usual muscular denseness. Small wonder that from the moment he appeared on stage, Danny was declared a favorite to win the Olympia, at long last. Fuller had been a lot sharper for his Grand Prix battles. Katz was bigger and better all around than he'd been in years, enough to encourage the belief that he might still prove his case against the steroid brigade. Ratty was way, way below his usual standard. Dickerson was as good as his best form. He did not participate in any of the onstage shenanigans that Callender had started with Colombo. Chris comported himself as if he truly believed dignity would be a deciding factor in this Neanderthal war. Ken Waller entered this contest knowing he never had a chance against these monsters. It was his way of letting Mensur and Co. know that he did not support their action against Arnold. But Ken may well have been in the best shape of his career. Roger Walker had been a lot better than he appeared in Columbus. Rodriguez was as impressive as always, but hardly good enough to stir up Olympia waves. It's difficult not to admire Steve Davis. His enthusiasm for bodybuilding never dims. And on this occasion, he did his thing on stage, seemingly oblivious of the incredible opposition. He had made obvious improvements to his body, but still there were the desperate cries of a really big man pleading to be released from the prison of Davis's current physique. Let him out, Steve. Let him out and watch your ratings rise. It's doubtful that Ed Corney competes these days with victory on his mind. His physique is nevertheless remarkable, and not only because he may be 50, a fine gentleman, Ed was outclassed in Columbus. During the early phase of the contest, Benute was at sea. Something in his eyes suggested his self-confidence had deserted him. If ideal proportions were all a man needed to win the Olympia, Benute may have been unbeatable. Metz reminded one of the 60s cats. He was never an Olympia threat. The first three to be called out for comparisons were Padilla, Callender, and Franco. With their respective supporters screaming encouragement, each man held his own. Then it was Dickerson's turn to be compared with Callender and Colombo. Stand up, Danny, came the shout from the back seats. Think big, Danny. You got him licked. If only Danny could have believed that. It might have made a difference in his stage attitude. It was becoming clearer and clearer that there was much more to the Olympia than muscles. A man's popularity, the way he carried himself on stage, his publicity, these were all factors to be considered. At one point, someone shouted, Waller, when are you going to return Mike's shirt? 5 years earlier in Pumping Iron, Waller had been made to look like a villain who had hidden a shirt belonging to Mike Katz. The fans had not forgotten. Lord knows there were many who had not forgiven Ken for the dastardly act that hadn't taken place. Now the judges called Tinarino, Callender, and Wilkosch. The last was out of his depth here, as many in the audience saw it. But then you couldn't decide on reasonable grounds who between Callender and Tinarino had a better physique. One was thicker, more densely muscled, but with obvious flaws. The other was handsome in the conventional movie star tradition, well-proportioned and taller, if not as heavily muscled. The audience knew exactly which man should be Mr. Olympia. But would it be harder on the judges who ultimately would have to stand by their scores? Callender and Dickerson were recalled for more comparisons, then Fuller and Padilla, then Platts and Wilkosch, and Padilla again. Once, while the judges were comparing Callender, Wilcosh, and Fuller, with Wilcosh in the middle, someone shouted, "Pumpernickel sandwich." Amidst the shouting, the excitement, and the boos that the implacable Oscar State called down upon his head by insisting on running the contest according to current rules, good humor prevailed. Nothing in round two adversely affected the popularity of Colombo, Callender, Dickerson, Platts, and Padilla with the crowd, but gradually the applause for Platts grew louder. His back and thigh seemed to inspire riotous behavior in the auditorium. And now for the round that everyone had been waiting for, free posing. Traditionally, this is the time that Dickerson separates himself from the boys, when miraculously, seemingly flawed body parts take on a new appearance as they blend together into the winning physique that has earned Dickerson a small fortune and much popular acclaim. On this occasion, however, you couldn't help noticing that Platts's thighs were more muscular and far larger than Dickerson's, and that Platts had a better back. Nevertheless, you still found yourself wondering if Dickerson's more pleasing shape would be enough to see him pass Platts. The judges would have to decide whether to pick a winner who had more muscle than any one man had a right to, or one who wasn't as gargantuan, but whose proportions were easier on the eye. And then there was Callender, who was as dangerous as a cornered panther and very popular with the audience. He hit poses that brought to mind the Oliva of the 60s. Franco hit all the poses that had made him famous. Still, the temptation was to concentrate on his thighs, which were too smooth, as the other contenders were flawless. When Benute took his turn on the rostrum, the audience let him know what a great champion he really is. He posed like an artist inspired. He moved gracefully and with confidence. At the end of his presentation, there were many who gave him a standing ovation. For once, a smile lit up the swarthy face of the Lion of Lebanon. Tenorino had loads of kisses for the fans, even though he must have sensed that a good number of them had sat on their hands when he was posing. It is possible that Dennis appears in the Olympia more for business reasons than out of any particular desire to win the title. Then again, perhaps he's waiting patiently, as Zane had waited patiently, for the Olympia fans to make his physique fashionable. If Danny Padilla showed anything in round three, it was the fact that he lacks the aggressiveness required of Olympia contenders. As he went through a relatively lackluster routine, one's mind turned to Schwarzenegger, who was famous for a stage manner that's the exact opposite of Padilla's. And once again, I wondered if, in fact, there is a room on Mount Olympia for nice guys. There was much audience support for Padilla in Columbus, but somewhere along the way, he'll probably deny this, he seemed to throw in the towel. Perhaps in the end, Callender and Platts proved too intimidating. Indeed, one week after the contest, Danny said, in effect, that he felt honored to be competing on the same stage as Colombo, who had been his hero for years. Now, where do you ever hear such talk from an Olympia contender? Minutes before the prejudging ended, Wag Bennett turned to me and said, "I really am surprised. A few days ago, I met Franco in Hawaii, and I told him he'd have no trouble winning in Columbus. I really believe this contest would be a mere formality. Franco looked unbeatable at Tommy Leong's gym." Well, now, I wouldn't bet on it. There would be more surprises. Dick Cooper has been a member of the Olympia Production Company since 1976. In 1970, he had attended his first bodybuilding event, a Mr. World contest produced by Jim Lorimer in Columbus, that is particularly famous for having given Arnold Schwarzenegger his first victory over Sergio Oliva. A stage designer who had worked in vaudeville for 25 years, Cooper had come away from Lorimer's show a little disappointed with the way the Mr. World contenders had been presented on stage. "Bodybuilding is such an exciting activity," says Cooper, "so full of life. It seemed a shame to present it to the public without proper window dressing, so to speak. That's like some director putting his lead actor in the spotlight without his stage makeup. Let's face it, bodybuilding is theater." And that's exactly how Cooper presented it from 1976, when Lorimer first hired him as a technical designer for the Olympia. In 1981, Cooper, however, surpassed himself. With special backlighting and ingenious use of the stage curtains, Cooper opened his evening performance with the Mr. International contenders blacked out and standing on strategically placed steps, each man in the pose for which he was most famous. The overall effect was a mountain of muscle and silhouette. Backed by the rousing theme from 2001, Cooper's introduction was enough to raise goosebumps on the neck of the most seasoned first-nighter. And as the Mr. Olympia audience was quick to applaud the genius of the show's technical designer. Soon it was time for Ben Weider's ritualistic speech at the mic. "I welcome you officially to the Mr. International and Mr. Olympia contest," said the IFBB president. My brother Joe created the Olympia competition because he wanted it to be the biggest and the best professional contest on the IFBB calendar. And that's exactly what it is. The IFBB has set a criterion for competition that is very high. To compete, leader paused long enough for a backseat heckler to interject, "Mentzer, where's Mike Mentzer?" Weider continued, "To compete in the Olympia, a bodybuilder must have been a Mr. Universe winner or placed first, second, or third in the IFBB's Grand Prix events. So it is my opinion tonight that this is the greatest Olympia ever presented. We have 17 Mr. Universe winners. Where's Mentzer and Co. and Zane?" More hecklers are joining in now. "Where's Beckles?" Weider persevered. "This would be the sixth Olympia staged in Columbus," he pointed out. Columbus had seen more Olympias than any other city in the world, and for good reason. Here we have the greatest organizational ability of the greatest promotional team in bodybuilding history. I am speaking about Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jim Lorimer. The announcement was greeted with equal measures of cheers and boos. But long after the cheers had died down, the hecklers continued. So now the political animal in Ben Weider reared his smiling face. "We live in a democracy," he said, "so everyone is free to express his personal opinion. But I'll tell you one thing for certain, and that is Arnold has played a critical role in the development of your favorite sport." It was a line guaranteed to reach the heart of this unruly but bodybuilding mad crowd, and it hit home. It was greeted with sustained "all rights, right ons," and ear-blasting whistles. The political Ben Weider gave his audience all the time it required to acknowledge Arnold's contributions to pro bodybuilding before moving on. "We love Arnold, we love Jim, and we are going to continue working with this great team. Together with the IFBB, they will go on presenting the best bodybuilding contest in this great city of Columbus." From this point, it seemed nothing could possibly spoil the evening. The fans had clearly been waiting for the slightest hint, the smallest assurance that there was a lot more saint than devil in the man they had worshipped for nearly two decades. And now that the political Ben Weider had reminded them so effectively of Arnold's contribution to their sport, they were ready to forget all past misdemeanors. Now only the future was important. Weider decided to quit while he was ahead. The IFBB president promised his audience the greatest Olympia ever. And with 4,000 throats cheering, he handed the microphone over to MC Len Boslin. The end. So we will have part four of this article next time on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Until then, train hard, take care, and we'll see you then. Take care, guys.